Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday Morning Update.
It is a Saturday Morning Update, and a happy Halloween to you. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf is behind the console. Jane Houghton, our producer this morning. No Halloween party for the president before he left for Europe. The Build Back Better circus continues in the Democratic Party. We'll talk about that in a moment. Plenty going on. The McAuliffe-Yunkin race in Virginia continues to tighten. The gubernatorial race in New Jersey, a little bit tighter. Phil Murphy still out in front, but that is tightening in New Jersey. I want to lead, though, with a story that you'll be hearing about. This is the latest we have from CBS News, and that is that police in Northern Virginia are on a heightened state of alert of a potential threat against malls and shopping centers located outside of Washington. The threat originated with ISIS and is the basis for the alert, and that is from CBS News last night, the law enforcement alert. Fairfax County Police Chief Kevin Davis saying that, quote, we have increased our police presence throughout the county to include major thoroughfares, transit hubs, shopping plazas, and shopping malls. Police say the increased law enforcement presence will be in place throughout the Halloween weekend and ahead of Election Day on Tuesday. Law enforcement officials say they are acting out of an abundance of caution, and as they learn more about the threat, the increased law enforcement presence could be extended through later in the week. ISIS has been more active since the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in August. The officials say the threats from the international terrorist group and Al-Qaeda are accelerating. The Department of Homeland Security's intelligence chief, John Cohen, said this week that the terror groups want individuals to act on their own. The so-called lone wolf attacks overseas and at home. Arlington County Police and the Loudoun County Sheriff's Office say they are not aware of any specific threats in the area. Still, they are encouraging people to be vigilant. Heather Curtis will be following this story from the WMAL newsroom throughout the day, and we'll cover it, obviously, straight through the week. We'll also talk with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer coming up in the 7 o'clock hour. He is tracking this and has been in touch with people overnight, so we'll be getting the latest read as well from Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer this morning. Now, the Build Back Better. Wow, this is back and forth. You've got two packages that the president was adamant that he wanted to have approved, some kind of an agreement between the Democrats in the House and the Democrats in the Senate, wanted this thing done before he left for Europe. Didn't get done. They did put out a framework memo. So this memo they put out from the White House was supposed to look like the deal was done, right? This was kind of the way they spin this on Friday. It didn't get done, but they put the framework memo out. Why is there such a problem? Well, it's two packages. You have infrastructure, and then you have the second package, which is the Build Back Better package, also known as the social package. Now, the Democrats, on the moderate side of things, have been trying to get the infrastructure package through, and then they'll get to Build Back Better, the social programs. Well, the squad is not having any of that. The squad says you are going to vote both of these bills at the same time, or you are not going to get our support on the reduced infrastructure package. Here are the sounds of the squad from yesterday. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, we have Ilhan Omar and Cori Bush.
We need a little bit more than an IOU.
We need to keep the promise that was made. We've been very clear. We need to see the two bills simultaneously move together.
I felt a little bamboozled because this was not what I thought was coming today.
So she felt bamboozled. Ilhan says, we're not going to do one without the other. So we are still in a logjam. To put it in perspective, this is Congressman James Comer. He is a Republican from Kentucky.
Well, it's just further proof that the progressives are running the Democrat agenda now in the House of Representatives to think that that bill wasn't enough spending for them shows just how far left they are.
How do you think Speaker Pelosi feels about all this? Can you imagine? And her, you know, her hair still doesn't get gray. It's pretty amazing. Chad Pergram, of course, is the congressional reporter, the Capitol Hill reporter and producer for Fox News. He asked Speaker Pelosi yesterday afternoon about this.
What's your response when you hear that sort of dissension in your caucus about where you stand when you present a very positive picture of where you are?
I have respect for all of our members on and the full spectrum of the big tent that is our Democratic Party. Everybody has the chance to say what they wish.
So we'll see what happens. That's a logjam. And the president went to Capitol Hill, tried to get a deal done before he left, and he didn't. So that's where we are. He's in Europe, met with the Pope yesterday. We'll talk with John Gizzi about that meeting coming up in the 7 o'clock hour. Have you been to the gas pumps recently? Have you seen the prices of gasoline? Have you seen the prices in the grocery stores? Well, the Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, says you can expect that to continue for a while, as well as the shortages. When it comes to oil production and obviously the price of your gasoline, what's going on here? Remember in the Trump administration that we were producing so much oil domestically, and then the Biden administration is changing that policy, the Trump policies, and you know the country was running pretty well when Trump was in. Well, here's Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio.
I'll tell you what's frustrating is a member of Congress telling American oil and gas companies to reduce production at the same time the President of the United States is begging OPEC to increase production. That may be the dumbest thing I've ever heard, but that's the scenario we're in. God bless Chevron saying they're going to increase production.
Maybe the dumbest thing he's ever heard. That's Jim Jordan on the Biden oil production. So, remember Adam Kinzinger? He's been a real thorn in the side of President Trump over the years and voted for Trump's impeachment. Well, Adam Kinzinger is not coming back. He is not going to be running for re-election in 2022. He'll explain it, and then I'll tell you the real reason why. Here's his spin on it.
In Congress, I've witnessed how division is heavily rooted. It has also become increasingly obvious to me that in order to break the narrative, I cannot focus on both a re-election to Congress and a broader fight nationwide. I want to make it clear. This isn't the end of my political future, but the beginning.
It's not the end, it's the beginning. That's what they all say. How come? Well, they are redistricting. The Democrats are in control in Ohio in the redistricting process, so he's getting gerrymandered, so he doesn't want to lose. What do you do? It's the Saturday morning update, and Michelle Murray's in the WML Traffic Center this morning.
On the inner loop of the Beltway between U.S. 50 Arlington Boulevard and 66, there had been construction that was leading traffic into the express lanes, and traffic had been very slow there, but looks like they have just picked up that road work, and the delays are easing in the area. Now, you will find that a portion of the Sligo Creek Parkway is still closed for flooding conditions between New Hampshire Avenue and East Wayne Avenue and between Colesville Road and University Boulevard. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly to mostly cloudy on this Saturday. We'll still have the possibility for some scattered showers. Temperatures, they should reach the low to mid-60s. We will still have that threat for coastal flooding today. In fact, the next high tide, Alexandria and Washington Harbor, they're right around the 4 o'clock hour this afternoon, closer to 4:30. So have that chance for additional flooding, particularly along the coastal and tidal areas. As we head later on tonight, mostly cloudy, patchy fog, lows back into the 50s. For your Sunday on Halloween, partly cloudy skies, breezy at times, high temperatures in the mid-60s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
57 soggy degrees in the nation's capital, 619 Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
Well, the race has certainly tightened in Northern Virginia between Terry McAuliffe and Glenn Youngkin. And it got ugly yesterday. You're all familiar with the Lincoln Project, right? We saw them kind of go down in flames not that long ago. Well, they're back. A group of people carrying tiki torches turned up at an event for Glenn Youngkin in Charlottesville. campaign rally. They posed in front of his tour bus. Well, they were carrying tiki torches, and the appearance was that they were Nazis. And the idea was to remind everybody of Charlottesville a few years back. Well, this group of people turns out to have been sent by the Lincoln Project. They are, of course, the anti-Trump Republican group. The tiki torches were a nod to the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. You remember the white supremacists and neo-Nazis marching with tiki torches in hand. Now, the stunt that the Lincoln Project pulled comes, obviously, as the gubernatorial election is on November 2nd, and the civil trial began against the rally's organizers. So, a local NBC reporter shared a photo of the group on Twitter, reporting they said something that sounded like, "We're all in for Glenn." That's attributed to local NBC reporter Elizabeth Holmes. So this is spreading online, and people online quickly beginning to suspect there was something strange about it. Youngkin's campaign even accused his opponent, Terry McAuliffe, of being behind the stunt. Well, Vice News identified one of the people in the photo as a, quote, low-level Democratic operative. Low-level, not low-life. And said the Lincoln Project admitted it was responsible for the stunt. In a statement, said, "Today's demonstration was our way of reminding Virginians what happened in Charlottesville 4 years ago and the Republican Party's embrace of those values and Glenn Youngkin's failure to condemn it." That from the Lincoln Project. The statement also said, if Youngkin, quote, will denounce Trump's assertion that Charlottesville rioters possessed very fine qualities, we'll withdraw the tiki torches. Until then, we'll be back. You may recall that back then, in 2017, in the same press conference, President Trump did denounce the Charlottesville rioters. McAuliffe's campaign condemned the stunt on Friday evening, but that was after two associates of Terry McAuliffe actually did social media posts yesterday afternoon to push the event. Those posts were later deleted. 6:23, it is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. It's the Saturday Morning Update, and we're at 6:23. And a little more on the gubernatorial race in Virginia. This is from Jonathan Turley. This is at Fox News, and I've got some audio from Jonathan. He was on last night. And here's what's written on this story. As a longstanding associate of the Clintons, Virginia Democratic gubernatorial candidate Terry McAuliffe has extensive ties with the Democratic establishment. That history was placed into sharp relief this week when he made a hefty down payment on the services of former Clinton counsel Mark Elias. Elias is a critical figure in the ongoing Durham investigation and has been accused of lying to the media to hide the role of the Clinton campaign in funding the Steele dossier. His former law partner, Michael Sussman at Perkins Coie, was recently indicted by Durham. Elias has also led efforts to challenge Democratic losses, even as he denounces Republicans for such election challenges. Elias has been sanctioned as part of a prior election case. McAuliffe may be preparing to challenge any win by Glenn Youngkin. He has given $53,680 to the Elias Law Group. This is Jonathan Turley writing, so let's have Jonathan Turley speak about it.
We have a special counsel investigation in the field looking at his role in the pushing of the Russian collusion scandal. His former partner, the person that represented the Clinton campaign with him at the firm, was just indicted. Elias himself has been sanctioned by a federal court. Two New York Times reporters said that he and the campaign directly lied to them in denying the role of the Clinton campaign and behind the Steele dossier. The Congress said that he was sitting next to John Podesta as counsel when Podesta denied that the Clinton campaign was behind the dossier. It wasn't until after the election that these stories came out. So why on earth, of all the election lawyers in Washington, would McAuliffe select this one. You could go to any corner in Washington, throw a stick, and hit six people experienced with election law. So why pick this one when there's a special counsel in the field looking at what he did in the last election?
Jonathan Turley on Fox News. It's 6:26 on the Saturday morning update. If you caught any of the Merrick Garland hearings on Capitol Hill in the Senate, wow, tough day for him. We're going to go into detail with Jim Trusty on that a little bit later on. But if you missed this story and missed some of the audio, this is Senator Josh Hawley going after the Attorney General Merrick Garland.
Several of my Democrat colleagues have today, just today in this hearing, multiple times have compared parents who show up at school board meetings, like Mr. Smith here, have compared them to criminal rioters. You think that's right? You think that a parent who shows up at a school board meeting, who has a complaint, who wants to voice that complaint, and maybe she doesn't use exactly the right grammar, you think they're akin to criminal rioters? Do you agree with that?
I do not, and I do not remember any senator here making that comparison.
Oh, really? These people are just like the folks who came here on January 6th and in the riot at the Capitol?
I don't think they were referring to the picture that you're showing there.
Well, I certainly would hope not, but they were referring to parents who go to school board meetings. Mr. Smith is a parent who went to a school board meeting.
The senator continued, and it was pretty rough for the attorney general.
I'll leave it at this, General Garland. You have weaponized the FBI and the Department of Justice. Your U.S. attorneys are now collecting and cataloging all the ways that they might prosecute parents like Mr. Smith because they want to be involved in their children's education, and they want to have a say in their elected officials. It's wrong. It is unprecedented, to my knowledge, in the history of this country, and I call on you to resign.
Senator Tom Cotton also questioning the Attorney General.
You've cited as the basis for that directive the National School Board Association's letter of September 29th. Was that directive being prepared before September 29th, before the School Board Association letter was issued?
I don't believe so. Certainly, I didn't have any idea.
So it was only prepared to ask? Okay, I think that answers the question.
I already answered that question.
So you keep citing the school board letter and news reports.
One of the news reports
cited in that letter, which you presumably mean, is from Loudoun County, Virginia.
No, that is not what I was talking about.
You keep citing news reports, and that's the most prominent news report that anyone in America has seen.
Senator Cotton closed it out with this line.
This testimony, your directive, your performance is shameful.
Okay. That's not.
Thank God you are not on the Supreme Court. You should resign in disgrace, Judge.
Ooh. Well, there was a light moment. It wasn't intended to be a light moment in this Senate hearing, but there was a little problem that Senator Cory Booker had with geography and his colleague, Ben Sasse. Of course, Ben Sasse from Nebraska.
I want to be respectful of my colleague, my friend, the senator from the great state of Oklahoma.
Ouch.
I'm sorry, sir. Forgive me. Omaha.
Omaha's not a state, brother.
I'm sorry. Where are you from, sir?
We used to be able to beat Stanford in football, and we will return. Chairwoman. Yeah, thank you. Sorry, Corey's not as funny as I thought he would be there.
Okay, so a little light moment. Anyway, we're coming up on 6:30. We're going to take a quick break, then we'll have a check of the news, and Jennifer Harper will join us. We've got Jim Trusty also coming up, John Gizzi on the president's trip and on that Virginia race. We'll be talking with Cheryl Atkinson this morning, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, looking into that situation with an ISIS threat in the Washington area, and we'll be joined later on by KT McFarland as well. We'll take a look at the president in Europe and where it goes next. Stay with us on the Saturday Morning Update. And in other news this morning, the Los Angeles Long Beach port complex will begin fining shipping companies if they let cargo containers stack up as the nation's busiest twin harbors deal with that unprecedented backlog of vessels. The L.A. and Long Beach Harbor Commissions voting yesterday to implement a joint program that sets time limits on how long containers can stay at marine terminals. New York prosecutors have asked a judge to order California lawyer Michael Avenatti to begin serving a 2.5-year prison term. That request yesterday comes a year after Avenatti was convicted of trying to extort up to $25 million from Nike. Later yesterday, Avenatti's lawyers responded by saying he should stay free until February 28th due to a January criminal trial he faces in appeals work as well. Avenatti became well known when he was representing Stormy Daniels in those lawsuits against the president at the time, President Trump. 6:32, and Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
In Silver Spring, there is an accident to watch out for that has the ramp from Westbound University Boulevard to the Beltway closed at this time, so do watch out for that. Also, you will find some flooding conditions right now in Virginia on the Alexandria waterfront that has King Street closed between South Lee Street and Wales Alley, and also flooding reported in Fairfax on Prosperity Avenue between Leroy Place and Morningside Drive. Also in Rock Creek Park, a portion of Beach Drive closed between the Maryland DC line and Knowles Avenue due to flooding conditions. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly to mostly cloudy on this Saturday. We'll still have the possibility for some scattered showers. Temperatures, they should reach the low to mid-60s. We will still have that threat for coastal flooding today. In fact, the next high tide, Alexandria and Washington Harbor, they're right around the 4 o'clock hour this afternoon, closer to 4:30. So have that chance for additional flooding, particularly along the coastal and tidal areas. As we head later on tonight, mostly cloudy, patchy fog, lows back into the 50s. For your Sunday on Halloween, partly cloudy skies, breezy at times, high temperatures in the mid-60s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
57 degrees on the Saturday morning update on WMAL 634.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
Saturday morning update. Happy Halloween weekend to you. I'm Rick Fowler. Jennifer Harper joins us this morning. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. And what are you dressing up as tomorrow?
I haven't decided yet, but I'll let you know.
So we're watching the governor's race in Virginia. Glenn Youngkin, the Republican candidate, got a nice boost from a former governor that is a Democrat.
Yeah, this was just really sort of one of these political cultural moments you have to look at. And this is indeed coming from Doug Wilder. He's the governor from 1990 to 94. He is a Democrat. And he came out publicly in an essay in the past week about Mr. Youngkin. And he was a very admiring essay because Mr. Youngkin supports helping out the historically black colleges of Virginia. And that was something that Mr. Wilder felt very strongly about, and this is what he said in his public statement. He said, when I watched Glenn Youngkin last evening commit to provide funding for all five of our historically black colleges and universities in any budget he submitted to the legislature if he was governor, it was historical. This is the first time any candidate for governor has made this public commitment. Anyway, it was a very positive thing and was pretty surprising in a lot of ways, but certainly Mr. Youngkin won this applause, and he's also winning applause in a very kind of a significant poll. Let's look at a Fox News poll that came up this week on Thursday, and Mr. Youngkin currently has the support of 53% of likely Virginia voters versus 45% who are going for Governor Terry McAuliffe, and this is an 8-point advantage, and that's pretty significant. And again, it came out on Thursday. And also, as an aside, Mr. Youngkin has managed to get some pretty positive coverage from, of all folks, the Washington Post. They did a large profile of him and included some very nice things about the hopeful. And also, he has put out, I guess, possibly his last campaign ad. And it's a very sort of a touching ad, and the last line in it is, on November 2nd, a new day begins in Virginia. So a lot of drama there, Rick.
So what's going on in Jersey?
Yeah, well, this is another sort of a similar situation because there are only two governor's races this time around in the whole United States. One is in Virginia, and the other is in New Jersey. And there's a big push on the incumbent, Phil Murphy. He's getting some real pushback from Jack Cittiarelli. And according to, for example, New York Magazine, they're saying the New Jersey governor's race is getting interesting and maybe even more competitive. Can Jack Cittiarelli beat Phil Murphy? polls show he has suddenly got a shot. That came from Newsweek, and Bloomberg News put it this way. Murphy's lead in New Jersey governor race has narrowed. So a couple of cliffhangers here, but the Youngkin race really looks interesting.
We have all seen inflation in the grocery stores and at the gas pump, but what about when it comes to our holidays, including tomorrow's?
Yeah, well, let's look at Halloween really quickly. Actually, there's a little good news associated with that because the National Retail Federation has done its own survey, and they are predicting that Americans are going to spend an all-time high of $10.1 billion on Halloween this year, and that's up from $8 billion last year. So that's a pretty big leap there for all of the things that go along with Halloween. But so that's kind of good news there. But let's go on to Thanksgiving, because Biden inflation has hit Thanksgiving dinner in no uncertain terms. And let's look at something that the New York Times said this week. They said, this year's Thanksgiving feast will wallop the wallet. Nearly every ingredient from the turkey to the after-dinner coffee is expected to cost more for a host of reasons. Of course, we always look to the Farm Bureau because they're the folks that put out the average price this year for a whole Thanksgiving dinner. And during President Trump's time in office, that was the lowest in 10 years. For example, last year it was $46.90 to feed a gathering of 10 people. That was back when former President Trump was in office. And, well, that's not going to come true this time. According to the Farm Bureau, they did put out a statement, although I haven't put out any numbers. They said when you go to the grocery store and it feels more expensive, that's because it is. And this is what they told CBS. They said food prices are up by 3.7% so far in 2020. Versus a 20-year average of about 2.4%. As a result, the overall tab for turkey and all the trimmings will cost 4 to 5% more this year than a year ago. And that's coming from the Farm Bureau and also an analysis by CBS. And all of the all of these kind of industry groups are also taking notice of this. And according to the National Turkey Federation, the American Sheep Industry Association, the Catfish Farmers of America, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, the National Pork Producers Council, the North American Meat Institute, the Catfish Institute, and United Egg Producers, we need lawmakers, they say, willing to have tough conversations to solve this problem and jumpstart rural America's recovery from the pandemic, because they are definitely looking at the price increases, the shutdowns, the chain disruptions, all of that, the dwindling skilled labor force, lots and lots of things like that. And one last thing about the attack of the Biden inflation, or the Bidenflation, as some say, the price of gas going up, up, up. The average price per gallon of gas nationwide is now $3.37, and this is according to GasBuddy.com. That's an industry source and a good one. And on November 1st, 2020, a year ago, the price was only $2.07. So Biden inflation is a factor.
You know, we'd all like to see some common sense in Washington, but if we can't find it here, you've got it coming from Minnesota.
Yeah, I make it a real point to watch some of the congressional races around the nation. And I took notice of one Republican hopeful in Minnesota. And she is taking a stand for civility. This is Cicely Davis. She's a black conservative, and she's challenging Representative Ilhan Omar, you know, Minnesota Democrat in the state's very blue 5th district. Ms. Davis, she describes herself as an everyday Minnesotan, and she's also not relying on political attacks and so forth to persuade some of the longtime Democratic voters up there to side with her. And I had to take notice of a statement that she issued this week, and here it is. It's kind of a something we can all think about. The politics of bashing the other side must end. The American people face real issues in their everyday lives, and politicians from both sides of the aisle must come together to fix them. America is the greatest country in the world. Our biggest threat is ourselves when we allow politics and infighting to rule the day over working together as one. Again, that's coming from Cicely Davis. She's a black conservative Republican in Minnesota.
When you kind of step back and look at all of this with the spending, and we're going to put a couple trillion here and a couple trillion there, is there some way that somebody's trying to put trillions into perspective for us?
Yes, there is. I found this to be very helpful this week because, you know, definitely people are bandying about the $1 trillion price tag with, you know, great abandon. And I've got a great quote here from Saul Anuzis. He's the former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party. He's now the president of 60 Plus. That is a nonpartisan group for seniors, conservative group. And here's what he had to say, which I thought made a lot of sense. He said, Democrats are trying to make a trillion sound normal. And his point is, it's not really normal. He says, so when Democrats tell you spending an extra $3.5 trillion or $5-plus trillion will actually cost the American taxpayer zero, don't forget to ask them about buying the Brooklyn Bridge as well. And, again, this is Saul Anuzis. He's a longtime Republican. But, you know, we have to also look back to one of the best bumper stickers that ever came out on this kind of subject. This is at least according to my records here at Inside the Beltway. And this was a bumper sticker that said, don't tell Obama what comes after a trillion. And, of course, a quadrillion comes after that. But it's really helpful to sometimes look at what the national debt is. And if you're curious, at any given moment, the Treasury Department has the debt clock that will tell you how much we have, and right now it's at $28 trillion, and you can check that out yourself at treasury.gov.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, and you can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. Thank you very much. We're going to talk to Jim Trusty next, but right now Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Silver Spring, you will still find the accident activity affecting the ramp from Westbound University Boulevard to go onto the Beltway. That right off-ramp is closed due to this accident. You will find slow-going traffic right now on 295 northbound between Laboratory Road and Malcolm X Avenue with a reported work zone there. And it looks like there may be some accident activity right now on southbound 395, the 3rd Street Tunnel, as you approach the freeway, so use extra caution there. Also, in Rock Creek Park, a portion of Beach Drive is still closed between the Maryland DC line and Knowles Avenue due to flooding. Now from GarageDroidPair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly to mostly cloudy on this Saturday. We'll still have the possibility for some scattered showers. Temperatures, they should reach the low to mid-60s. We will still have that threat for coastal flooding today. In fact, the next high tide, Alexandria and Washington Harbor, they're right around the 4 o'clock hour this afternoon, closer to 4:30. So have that chance for additional flooding, particularly along the coastal and tidal areas. As we head later on tonight, mostly cloudy, patchy fog, lows back into the 50s for your Sunday on Halloween. Partly cloudy skies, breezy at times, high temperatures in the mid-60s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
57 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:45, the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
Saturday morning update, Halloween weekend. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty joins us, partner at IFRA Law, the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
So the former New York governor, now disgraced, charged with assault this week, and it stems out of the investigation of the multiple claims by multiple women who had interactions with him over the years. What do we know about this so far, Jim?
Yeah, we know a little. I mean, the district attorney's office in Albany charged him with the forcible touching. That's the misdemeanor statute in New York that covers things like sexual assault. For the assault of Brittany Camiso, who was an aide to him, and this apparently took place in the governor's mansion on December 7th of 2020, a day that will live in Cuomo infamy. So she's one of the more recent events with that happening so recently. It's well within the two-year statute of limitations for a forcible touching charge. And she was one of the people, one of the 11, that gave interviews to the attorney general's probe, and she's even done a televised interview on CBS since then.
Now, I guess the question is, in a case like this, if it's a he said, she said, what evidence, if any, does the prosecutor have to go on?
Yeah, that's a great question, because even though it's a misdemeanor, we're still talking about proof beyond a reasonable doubt if they're going to win the day at trial, and I certainly expect it to be a trial. The charging document for a misdemeanor like this is pretty skimpy. You know, it's not something like a federal indictment that might, you know, kill a couple of trees in terms of describing a scheme. It's very, very light in terms of details. It does rattle off some types of evidence that support the charge, but the one category of which that I think is interesting is it mentions that there's a text message from Cuomo's phone. So that to me could be one of these tiebreaker pieces of evidence. You don't know, I mean, but there's a decent chance that there's something that he said immediately after the event, either apologizing to her, bragging to somebody, who knows. But that's the type of evidence that could really come back to haunt him. And they did check that box for a text message, so we'll have to wait and see. And, of course, the big question, Rick, in the grand scheme of things, is she going to be the only victim testifying, or is the court going to allow any or all of the other 10 victims from the report to come forward? I mean, that's a huge question. That's essentially, you know, mirrors the Bill Cosby litigation, where a trial with one victim was difficult, a trial with five or six was a very different story.
So what you're saying is, based on the limited information we have, there's more to it than a he said, she said, because would a prosecutor go to court if it was just her word versus his word?
Well, that's a great question, actually, because, yeah, sometimes they know it's a tough case. I mean, sometimes prosecutors will bring forward a case because they believe the victim. They don't think the victim has any motivation to lie, and they're comfortable giving it their best shot in front of a jury. It doesn't mean that they're overconfident that they'll have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's going to be interesting. I think it's definitely going to be a trial. It should move relatively quickly as a misdemeanor, with his initial appearance scheduled for November 17th, just a couple of weeks down the road. And, again, big question of whether a victim who testified in the more friendly confines of the Attorney General's office will hold up to cross-examination from Cuomo's attorney.
Let's turn to the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, on Capitol Hill earlier this week, Senate hearings. Among the comments to the Attorney General, a couple of senators were pleased that he had not made it to the Supreme Court, and a couple of senators also asking for his resignation. That's the political side. Let's look at it from your perspective, Jim. What did you see as the highlights?
Well, I think they were more like lowlights. I mean, I am disappointed. I've lived through a number of attorney generals when I was at the Department of Justice or at the U.S. Attorney's Office, everybody from Reno to Ashcroft to Holder, and some points in between. And it's just very disturbing, particularly when it relates to this National School Board Association letter. And, Rick, by the time of his testimony this week, they had already withdrawn their letter, which had equated parents to domestic terrorists. And so it was really kind of a perfect opportunity to try to beat a dignified retreat, you know, for Garland to essentially say, maybe we overreacted, maybe we've overreached, you know, let's wait and see how local law enforcement deals with any issues. Instead, he tries to draw this very fine line, nuanced distinction that I don't think sells. He says, well, we didn't adopt their language about terrorism, meaning when I wrote my memo as attorney general, I didn't call them terrorists. But at the same time, he was setting up a task force with participation from the Civil Rights Division and from the National Security Division. National Security Division has one main responsibility, that is terrorism cases. So, you know, he's drawing these distinctions that come off as very artificial, and I think the sad part of all of it is he's just not showing that federalism factors into his thinking at all.
You mentioned the term federalism, but in what I saw of the hearings, it appeared that most of these cases would be local in nature. And how is it that the federal government gets involved and goes in with a task force when it's a parent threatening, supposedly, at a local school board meeting?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the problem, and that's what I'm talking about with federalism. And the evidence, if you want to call it that, from the original letter was mostly First Amendment protected behavior. I mean, there's a tiny smattering of state offenses like trespassing that were mentioned, but most of the conduct that they were complaining of in that letter was unruliness or making things chaotic or being hateful. I mean, all of these non-crimes and at the most state crimes. And in fact, when Garland testified the other day and continued to double down on the notion that they should be investigating at the most state crimes in these school board meetings, the only time you really heard him mention state jurisdiction was when he was pressed about bathroom rapes in the Loudoun County schools. He essentially begged off the conversation by saying, well, those are state cases. Well, no kidding. I mean, they are state cases, but it's going to the point that he's completely ignoring the capabilities of local law enforcement to handle a local thing. You know, all this hearing, he kept taking this vacuous road of saying, well, DOJ is not against parents. We're against violence. And again, I just don't think that sells. It's this kind of aw shucks. All we're doing is investigating. We haven't charged anybody. It's not what people expect of federal prosecutors, of the FBI, of the limited resources of the federal government to look into crimes. It's certainly not supposed to be looking into a guy who stays too long at a school board meeting or yells the wrong things about critical race theory. And I have to step back for just a quick second on the basic process here, which is, again, what kind of bothers me as a longtime DOJ person. You know, there's a lot of questions how this letter even got generated in the first place, whether the White House coordinated with it, and maybe that would explain why this attorney general would just jump in with all fours to support it. But notice that not a single law enforcement agency across the country has reached out to DOJ saying, we can't handle all these threats and violence and worries at school board meetings. So nobody from law enforcement asked for it. And frankly, DOJ gets a letter every day of every week of every month from people saying, hey, please go investigate this, that, or the other. Sometimes legitimate, sometimes bona fide crazy. But they get those letters and ignore them all the time because they are local issues. But this particular attorney general was all too happy to jump in all fours on an investigation where even the letter writers have retracted it.
The topic of Hunter Biden came up, and what do you make of what may be going on, if anything, at the Department of Justice on that?
Well, I think my overall picture of the current attorney general is making me take a pretty negative view there. I mean, Hunter Biden was mentioned during Garland's testimony because he recently sold a piece of art, and I'll put quotes around the word art, for $500,000. Pretty amazing. You know, quite the progeny that he can sell that well for, you know, basic watercolors. But in any event, Garland came into the hearing and threw up the shield of there's a pending investigation, so he couldn't comment about Hunter Biden. And, you know, that has dragged on for a while. We knew that the FBI was looking at the laptop. We knew that there were issues. His attorneys were calling it a tax problem, which was probably euphemistic for bigger problems. So I'm really getting concerned with the way Garland is being a very political figure at DOJ, that we're going to hit some Friday afternoon where we hear that Hunter's case has been resolved with this extraordinary outcome, something like a no-jail plea to a misdemeanor for tax evasion or something that most clients in the white-collar world could never even dream of asking for, but that might land on Hunter Biden's lap to make his case go away.
Speaking of the DOJ and politics, story circulating end of the week that there are discussions underway between three government entities about payments to illegal immigrants whose children were separated when they came into the country during the Trump administration. What do we know about this?
Well, not a lot. It's really not getting very detailed airplay anywhere, and I spent some time looking for stories, and they really don't give you too much detail. But the three parts of the government that are involved in these negotiations are DOJ, Health and Human Services, and Homeland Security. They are responding to a number of claims, lawsuits being filed across the country, a lot of it with ACLU support, by illegal alien families claiming that they have had lasting psychological damage from separating minors from parents, and that they are going to sue all around the country. And there's about 940 different claims so far that have been identified, at least. So these are civil suits for intentional infliction of emotional distress, complaining about separation and the conditions of separation. And you'll remember the heart of the problem, Rick, was that illegal aliens that were detained when they came to the United States can't have a bunch of kids in the jails where they are detained. So several administrations have really struggled with the idea of how do you protect separated kids from the harm of being in an adult jail, but also not cause additional harm while they are separated from their own parents. And there's no doubt it's a thorny problem and a bad problem and not the outcome anybody was kind of rooting for when it comes to immigration enforcement. But it's turning into another one of these jackpot moments where the lawyers for the illegal aliens are pushing every button and finding a very friendly ear in the Biden administration. And we had a case a couple of years ago for the same event. One parent, one child got $125,000 as a settlement in New Jersey. So you'd think, well, maybe that's a little bit of the kind of going rate for being a victim of this strict enforcement policy. But what's happening now is everyone who makes a claim has a three-year parole period, meaning they can stay in the U.S. without any consequences for 3 years. The ACLU is demanding that they get a pathway to citizenship, as they call it, just for filing these suits. And the representatives from the government, again, DOJ, HHS, Homeland Security, are apparently mulling over a super fund where aliens would be able to collect a jackpot about $450,000 a head. This is a huge windfall for a lot of instances that may involve 17-year-olds that are intentionally separated from their parents. I mean, there's nuance between these cases where not every one of them should be recovering really anything. So it's going to be interesting. And the wrinkle that we saw this week was one of the government attorneys, unnamed, walked out of these negotiations basically saying this is absurd that we're picking numbers as high as $450,000 a person. You know, one of the politicians during the hearing pointed out to Garland that a full life insurance policy, standard policy for a military member, allows for a $400,000 recovery upon death. So we're talking about people that chose to come into the country illegally, knowing that there's a decent chance that they'll either be apprehended or that their families will be broken up temporarily, and they're getting a bigger $450,000 a person than families of deceased veterans.
Let's keep an eye on this one. Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. You can follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. As always, Jim, thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you. Have a great Halloween.
And you too. 7 o'clock news next with Heather Curtis, back with John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkinson, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and KT McFarland.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. The one radio station for you to depend on. All day, every day. 105.9 FM, WMAL, a Cumulus Media station.